Hello, and welcome to There's Hope with Homeopathy. This monthly show airs the third Friday of each month and focuses on classical homeopathic treatment, how it can benefit your entire family, and especially how it can be a curative therapy in the treatment of autism. My name is Amy Lansky, and I'm broadcasting from Portola Valley, California, in the San Francisco Bay Area. Today's show will air on November 16th, 2007. So, welcome everybody. Well, we're getting near the end of 2007. Hard to believe, really. What's new in the news today? Let's see. Well, the one thing actually that came up in October, and actually I'm recording this in October, is the recall of cold and cough medicines, allopathic conventional cold and cough medicines for very young children. Now, this is no surprise to homeopaths because these kinds of drugs are viewed as merely suppressive. That is, they just suppress the cold and cough symptoms. They don't cure a cold and cough. And therefore, because they operate merely by suppression, they tend to drive disease deeper into the body, and therefore you get what conventional doctors call side effects, what homeopaths call a natural consequence of suppression of symptoms. So what's a mother to do? What's a mother or father to do for a young two-year-old child with a cold or cough? Well, homeopathy. Of course, a cold, the most common sense answer to this question is, hey, if your kid has a cold or a cough, do what your mother did when you were growing up. There's no need to suppress it, unless the child is in real danger. Just keep him home and give him, lots of liquids and loving care and bed rest, and your child will learn to heal on their own, which is what their body's supposed to learn how to do. But if you need a little help, homeopathy does have the answer, and it can actually help cure the cold or cough, not simply suppress symptoms. There's many ways to find out how you can get help on your own. If you go to the health food store, you'll find lots of over-the-counter homeopathic cold and cough medicines. These are usually adequate for a simple cold and cough, but if you really want to get more expert care, or if your child tends to have chronic problems, I really recommend that you see a homeopath. And to find out about that, you can either look at the referral lists on my book website, impossiblecure.com. You go to the autism and referral page, and you'll find referral lists there. But the other answer is to go to the site of the National Center for Homeopathy, which is nationalcenterforhomeopathy.org. Actually, I work on this website. I'm on the board of the NCH, and that we released a press release that's accessible from the home page right now about the cold and cough problem. There's a link there to a discussion about homeopathic treatment of colds and coughs, and there's a sample article with a list of typical remedies. And if you actually join the NCH, which I encourage you all to do, you'll actually have access to you'll get hard copies of NCH's magazine, Homeopathy Today, which always has articles every year about colds and cough treatment. But you'll also get access to Homeopathy Today online if you're a member, and you can access old archived articles from Homeopathy Today and that have, handy tips on treating colds and coughs. So I just got to say, though, since my family and I in particular have been doing homeopathy, I used to get colds that were getting worse and worse. 10 years ago, let me see, I guess it's more than 10 years ago now, but before I was treated homeopathically every year, I would get sick more and more, and the colds would start colds and flus lasting like 2 weeks, 3 weeks. It was really miserable. Since I've been treated by a homeopath, I very rarely get a cold or a cough. When I do, I don't even have to treat it at all. I just, rest for a few days and it's gone. So I'm less susceptible. I get better much faster. Also, another handy tip, if you This is not homeopathy, but if you have colds and coughs going around in the schools, it doesn't hurt to do a little preventive measures with your kids. Of course, one of them is a little bit of vitamin C, you know, drink more, or orange juice, do more of that. There's echinacea, which you can take in moderation on a regular basis. And another thing that I found out actually from the Mercola website, and I find very interesting, is the use of hydrogen peroxide. Get some hydrogen peroxide. It costs barely nothing in the drugstore, and fill a little dropper bottle. And if you put a couple drops of hydrogen peroxide in your ear, and let it sit there for like a minute or two, do it in each ear. If you suddenly hear like it's bubbling away in your ear, you just keep it in there. It kind of gets real tickly. But what hydrogen peroxide actually kills bacteria. And the theory is that many colds enter through your ear, not just through your mouth. And this kills off bacteria that are entering through your ear into your eustachian tubes. I have found this to be very helpful if I know I'm being exposed to germs, to colds and coughs. So that's another little tip. Okay, but let's go back. Before I start the show, okay, today's show is going to be about a hot topic. I know for some of you, if you're total novices to homeopathy, you will not know exactly what I'm talking about. Well, you'll understand this show, but you won't know why I'm talking about this topic, which is the topic of miasms. For those of you who are regular listeners, if you participate on homeopathic lists, you'll be very interested in this show because a lot of practitioners and people talk about the concept of miasms, and it's a confusing topic. So today we're going to have an introduction to the notion of miasms. Next month's show, the December show, I'm going to be having an interview with homeopath Ian Lupker. He's one of the co-authors of a book about treatment of autism and especially Asperger's. So that's December show. But before I get into today's show, let me just remind you what I do every show, which is to check out the ImpossibleCure.com website. I'm the author of what's now pretty much the best-selling introductory book on homeopathy on Amazon anyway. And you can find out all about it and how to buy it at ImpossibleCure.com. Also on that website, there's an autism page that discusses homeopathic treatment of autism with referrals to practitioners. Also annotated archives of this show. You can listen to the show. There's almost 3 years worth of show now that are available from a link on the homepage. And I really encourage people to do that because this show is essentially like a short course about homeopathy, and you'll learn quite a lot, and it's all free. There's the Cure Stories database contributed by patients, and I really encourage you to contribute your own story, small, large. Doesn't have to be a complete cure, but something, anything you contribute will help others, encourage others to try homeopathy. You can find out how to order Impossible Cure in bulk. You might start thinking about that for your Christmas gift this year. And also a reminder that feel free to send me an email if you have a question, Lansky@ImpossibleCure.com or alansky@autism1.org. It all goes to the same place. So that's about it for now. So let's move on to miasms. Well, let's start with a definition of what a miasm is. If you go to the dictionary, what it'll say is a miasm is a noxious atmosphere or influence. And Hahnemann took this word, actually the original notion of a miasm in the time of Hahnemann, like in the early 1800s, was that it was like a mist or a fog coming off off the land that brought in disease, like from, you know, from a bog or something like that. So it's a toxic atmosphere of some kind. And he just adapted that word to homeopathy to mean that it's an influence, an unseen influence that causes disease. And in fact, it causes a disease tendency. And it was specially used to refer to infectious disease, that it caused infectious disease. It was kind of like a disease energy. And let's not forget, too, that there was no notion of bacteria or viruses back then. Even though it's true that, bacteria and viruses are involved in disease, it's actually become questionable whether they actually cause disease. Well, not according to conventional medicine, but according to homeopathic thought, believe it or not, this is a bit controversial, that it may, on an energetic level, what causes disease is a disease energy. And the question is, do the bacteria or viruses carry that disease energy, or do they just accompany that disease energy, that they're attracted to that disease energy? But that's a separate issue. So a miasm is some kind of influence that causes disease. And not only can you catch it, not only can this energetic disease influence be acquired by a person during their lifetime, but it can actually be inherited. And that's considered controversial. Can a child inherit a disease tendency, an energetic disease tendency, from their parents? Now, if you believe that the genome can't be changed, then you don't think that's true. So let's have an example of this. Let's say your great-grandfather acquired tuberculosis. And so he got tuberculosis. The idea behind the miasmatic theory is that since he got tuberculosis, he also acquired the disease tendency, this miasm, what might be called a tubercular miasm, an energy in his body. And not only did he have it in his lifetime, but he passed it on to his children. So that is the idea of a miasm. And actually, from a genetic point of view, this is considered Lamarckian evolution, that not only are genes passed on, but a characteristic can be acquired during the person's lifetime, and also passed on to the children. And there's more and more evidence that this is actually true in recent years, scientific studies. I was just reading about something yesterday, that there's been studies done with rats where they were given, let's say, a disease like diabetes, and this was then passed on, this disease tendency was passed on to the offspring. Anyway, I'm going to backtrack a little. You know, originally I was going to put stuff about miasms in my book. I think there's a very little about miasms in the book. But I took it out because I was advised by, some of the readers of the book to take it out, because homeopaths who were reading the book, because they thought it would be confusing to lay people, to non-homeopaths. But the reason why I decided to bring it up is because more and more people who are being treated are hearing about miasms and about being treated for miasms. And in fact, will say, well, you're not treating me for my child's miasms. So you're not a good homeopath. So I wanted to explain what miasms are all about, and how homeopaths use that information, so that you won't have any confusion, so that you'll understand perhaps more why your homeopath is or isn't using this information, or how they may be using that information in ways that you don't understand. It may seem like they're not, quote-unquote, treating your child for their miasms, but they really are doing so. So, and I also want to say that the use of miasms in homeopathic treatment has always been controversial, even within homeopathy, and there's lots of controversy about it, like how it's used, what miasms there are, whether you need to use it, whether or not, etc. So it's not a cut and dry subject. But I'm going to give you sort of an introduction to it, a broad brush introduction, and even get into more advanced recent topics with respect to miasms. Okay. So going back now, okay, a miasm is an influence that causes disease. It can be acquired during a person's lifetime, often because they've been infected with a infectious disease, or it can be inherited from one's ancestors. Vitulkas, who's a very prominent homeopath, calls it a predisposition towards chronic disease that underlies the acute manifestations of illness, which is transmissible from generation to generation. So from this perspective, it can just be viewed as a disease tendency that you acquire from your ancestors. So how did Hahnemann, you know, come up with this idea of miasms? And Hahnemann, once again, of course, is the founder of homeopathy. Well, he found that when he was treating merely based on the law of similars, taking a person's symptoms, finding a remedy that matched the symptoms and giving it, often wasn't sufficient. He found that it worked very well for acute diseases, but less so for chronic diseases, in that, you know, a person has some chronic disease. Each episode might have been treated successfully by the homeopathic remedy, but they kept getting them again and again. They still had the chronic disease. So he had the intuition that there was some underlying cause or underlying symptoms, some influence that was still present in the patient that was not being treated the way he was normally using the remedies. So he embarked on a study for over a decade to study this problem, take really in-depth case histories of his patients who had chronic disease. And he found out something very interesting. Now, if only today's doctors would do something like that, really do a long-term study of chronic disease tendencies in their patients, something they just simply don't do because they just view this as a fact of life, nothing to be done about it. But Hahnemann wasn't satisfied with that. He wanted to actually cure chronic disease. Why do we even call something a chronic disease? Because allopathy can't cure it. It's just chronic, right? But Hahnemann wanted to cure chronic disease. So he found, at least in the population of his patients back in the 1800s, that there tended to be three different kinds of disease tendencies. And he called them sora, syphilis, and psychosis. Sora is spelled P-S-O-R-A. Syphilis, like the disease syphilis, and psychosis is not like the mental illness psychosis, but is spelled S-Y-C-O-S-I-S. And I'll explain why he called it that. So as he looked back into the history of his patients as well, he also noticed that those who had these three different disease tendencies, that back in their ancestry there was some episode of disease in themselves or an ancestor of some disease, of a particular disease. So for the patients who had this soric tendency, somewhere back in their ancestry or in their own life, they tended to have what they called the itch, which was essentially scabies. If the person was syphilitic, what they called syphilitic, then there was some prior history of syphilis. And if they had the psychotic miasm, the psychosis, which is taken from the word of a word for fig warts, these genital warts, that at some point in the family history there was an instance of gonorrhea. So, you know, if your homeopath says to you, well, did you ever have gonorrhea, or did some ancestor of yours ever have gonorrhea, you know, it's an uncomfortable question, but in most of our family histories there are people who had these diseases. You know, this is not personal. It's sort of something that all of our families have had to deal with somewhere back in our history. Then they're trying to, you know, find confirmation for a particular miasm. That's why they're asking questions like that. And Hahnemann wrote up his findings in a book, in a landmark book that he called The Chronic Diseases. So that was the first conception of miasms, which was that there were these three different disease tendencies, psoriasis, syphilis, and psychosis, that originated from either the scabies, syphilis, or gonorrhea, that in particular probably had been suppressed. And back in those days, people were given toxic doses of mercury, for example, to treat syphilis. So if the syphilis was suppressed with mercury, then the miasm or taint would be impressed into the person and transmitted on. So each of these three classes or three types of miasms was, if you had this miasm, it didn't mean that you had syphilis. It meant that you had a certain broad class of characteristics that were indicative of the syphilitic miasm. And these characteristics were in personality, in how you looked physically, in certain, you know, just general patterns, like your sweat patterns, your sleep patterns, your food cravings, etc. Typical, you know, homeopathic symptoms, as well as a tendency to get certain diseases. So as part of the homeopathic interview, you would look for these certain kinds of characteristics, and often it's not totally clear-cut, because people usually, especially today, have more than one miasm. But you kind of look and see, well, does this person's symptoms tend to be more in the psoriatic miasm, in the syphilitic miasm, in the psychotic miasm? You look and see, sort of as a general feeling, what this person's disease, their symptoms tend to be. And you'll say, okay, you'll classify them into a particular miasm. And that's how this information is used. Similarly, every remedy has its hundreds, thousands of symptoms. But in general, it tends to be more or less, fit more or less into one of the miasms. And that's how this information is used. So let's say a patient comes into you, and you get all their symptoms, and you say, they got all these symptoms, and these symptoms match these three different remedies. And you can't decide which remedy to give. But the patient seems to be in the psoriatic miasm. And let's say the three remedies you pick, A, B, and C, A is more of a psoriatic remedy, but B and C aren't. That would guide you to giving remedy A, because it fits the miasm. The remedy is in the same miasm as in the patient. So that is really how Hahnemann intended and used the notion of miasms. It was just another way to further narrow down and give the correct remedy to the patient. And he found that when he enhanced his choice of remedies using this miasmatic information, he found he finally was able to get cures of chronic disease. So that was the original and really his intended use of miasmatic information. So viewed from this perspective, of course, the miasm of the patient is really just another symptom. And it's just another piece of information. And so a lot of homeopaths, including Vatulkas, by the way, who's a very famous homeopath, thinks that you don't really need to worry so much about miasms. You just take a more complete case, or miasms is just another symptom of the case, and then you just use that information to further hone in on the correct remedy. But there's other homeopaths who feel that using miasms is very, very important, and really even guides them completely in their case analysis. So there's lots of perspectives on the use of miasms. So before I continue on now, let me just give you sort of a feeling for these three main miasms, and I'll be talking about how there's now this theory has been expanded to include more miasms. But let's just begin with the three basic miasms, the sort of the mother lode, the sort of central core of the miasmatic theory. What are they like? So let's start with Sora. Sora is sometimes called the mother of all diseases, and it's viewed as that every human being has some Sora in them because it was the original disease, and it was founded in the scabies disease, the itch. And if you read like about Sora in the homeopathic literature, they'll say things like, you know, the caveman was afflicted by the itch. It epitomized a certain mentality that they had to have, that they were acquired because of this, because of their state of life, the early man, which is this feeling of sort of downtroddenness, but just having to put up with it. The feeling that you might have if you had the scabies, it's like, I got this itch, but I can't get rid of it. There's nothing I can do about it, but I'm just going to live with it. It's a kind of neurotic or an anxious feeling as well. So a psoriatic patient has what's considered underfunction, that they just can't mount enough response to their symptoms to overcome a disease. So there's a kind of weakness or deficiency in the person. They tend to get skin diseases or diseases that where there's a lot of mucus problems. So allergy problems and eczema problems are very typical of the psoriatic patient and would explain why a person who has the psoriatic tendency might start with eczema, let's say in a child, and if that's suppressed, it will move into allergies. They tend to be dry. Their skin tends to be dry, have dryness. And when they have diseases, it tends to be a functional disease, not a pathological disease. So they may, you know, have problems, but they're usually not things that are going to kill them, not to kill them so quickly. So of all the miasms, it's probably one of the most functional, one of the most healthy miasms to have if you're going to have them. There might be other types of problems with underfunction, infertility, impotence, lymphatic diseases. There's a tendency to be debilitated or emaciated, tendency to be cold, and a tendency to be kind of neurotic and anxious. So that's the image of the psoriatic person. And of course, like any of these things, there can be a healthy psoriatic person who just has a little bit of this tendency, or a more ill psoriatic person who has these characteristics much more deeply. So that's Sora. Okay, the next disease category is the psychotic miasm, and this is considered to originate from gonorrhea. And the general catchword for this miasm is overfunction or excess. So this person tends to have too much, and their body tends to produce too much, so they tend to get lots of warts, growths, cysts. They tend to be very inflammatory, so they'll be very, in their personality, very irritable, very hurried, very restless, very perhaps flamboyant. They will produce too much discharges, foul-smelling discharges, especially urogenital discharges. They tend to have problems with the liver, the gallbladder, to have rheumatic problems, to be very sweaty. They tend to be worse during the day and definitely worse in the damp or the cold. So that's the psychotic miasm. Too much. The body's producing too much. And finally, the syphilitic miasm, which is sometimes called the leutic, L-E-U-T-I-C, miasm, because I think people don't want to talk about the word syphilis. But this is of the three, probably the deepest miasm. And it is one that's characterized by self-destruction, the body destroying itself. So there tends to be things like ulceration. The body is decaying within. the person tends to be thin, exhausted, and have very much deeper emotional symptoms like fears, suicidal, self-destruction, psychotic impulses, and compulsions. Like if somebody has chronic, you know, desire to wash their hands, that's considered a very syphilitic type of symptom. Often their skeletal features are more disfigured, like the head might be misshapen. And there does tend to have a tendency in the physical realm to have a degeneration of bones or nervous system degenerative symptoms like paralysis, cancer, malignancies, leukemia. So that is the syphilitic miasm. And like I said, you know, a person who could be very healthy and have the syphilitic miasm, but just kind of lightly, that's just their disease tendency. Or a person can be very ill and manifest this, and then they'll have much worse symptoms. So over the years, people started using the miasmatic theories, and they expanded upon them. And even this began in Hahnemann's time. He started recognizing there were more miasms than just these three initial ones. And the first one that emerged was the tubercular miasm, and I mentioned this earlier. Originally, Hahnemann called it pseudosora. Then he was said that it was a combination of sora and syphilis, which is the tubercular miasm. And as we know, tuberculosis became much more of a problem in the 1800s. And then after a while, it also passed. And of course, there was the use of antibiotics for tuberculosis. But in general, what you find is that as one disease rises and is successfully suppressed, it might go into quiescence. And then the miasm of that disease remains in the population and is passed on. So after the 1800s, a tubercular miasm became much more common among people because of this residual miasm left behind from past history of the disease. So the tubercular miasm is still very prominent in today's population. And I'll give you a little profile of what its characteristics tend to be. You can think of a tubercular person is a person who is very overactive and then collapses. The symptoms tend to be very changeable, and their personality tends to be changeable. They'll often change their jobs, change their house, their friends, their partners. And in the physical plane, they tend to get a lot of colds and coughs. So they have these kind of respiratory problems, just like tuberculosis. And so, you know, everything will always go to the cough. They often tend to have red cheeks, and they tend to have fears of large animals, like black dogs especially. They feel worse in the damp and the warm, but they feel better in the cool mountain air. So I think it was Heidi who had, maybe Heidi had tuberculosis, and that's during her parents sent her up to live with her grandfather up in the mountains because it made tubercular people feel better.
But then More and more
miasms seem to be developing, and the one of the more recent ones is the cancer miasm, and we see that quite a lot. After tuberculosis became a kind of quiesced, then cancer started being a real problem, and as that is now being suppressed over several generations, the cancer miasm is being transmitted into the population of children. And this in particular is considered a very prominent one among autistic children, although the psychotic miasm and the tubercular miasm are also very common too. Now, cancer, from a theory point of view, is considered a combination of all three of the basic miasms, psoriasis, syphilis, and psychosis. And I'm not going to go into the characteristics of the Cancer miasm, but the certain personality characteristics include this perfectionism. I'll talk a little bit more about this, about that in a second. Okay. So, but before I go on, each of the miasms, as I said, you know, any particular remedy will tend to fit into one or two of these miasms because of the natural characteristics of that remedy. But there are certain remedies that are considered very canonical of a particular miasm. So for psora, the most common psoric remedy is sulfur. And as we know, sulfur is very commonly used for skin diseases. It may not be, if your child is psoric, heavily psoric, sulfur might be the right remedy for them, or it might not. But sulfur is sort of considered to be a picture of psora. Similarly, for the syphilitic miasm, not surprisingly, because this substance was used to treat syphilis, the most canonical remedy for the syphilitic miasm is mercury. And interesting that many of our children are affected by mercury poisoning. So many people feel that the syphilitic miasm is high in autistic children. Although I've heard more successes with other remedies, but in the cancer or psychotic miasms or tubercular miasms, but mercury is the canonical remedy for the syphilitic miasm. And for the psychotic miasm is thuya, which is made from a tree. So thuya is a very typical remedy for warts. And as we know, the psychotic miasm tends to produce growths like warts. So just so that you know these typical remedies for these miasms. Okay, so let's move on now to how these miasms are used today. In recent years, there's been a lot of expansion of ideas about the miasms. People say, well, you know, in Hahnemann's day, people were much more generally healthy. There weren't as complex diseases, but now there's much more, because of suppression, really, by conventional medicine, the diseases are much more deep and complex. And so there's been theories about up to, at this point, 10 miasms. These include the ringworm miasm, the malaria miasm, typhoid, cancer, leprosy, tuberculosis, psora, like the scabies, syphilis, gonorrhea, which is the psychotic miasm, also what's called the acute miasm. Most of us are considered to have more than one miasm within us, although only one may be the uppermost. And so when you're treating, you always treat the thing that's uppermost, the symptoms that are most problematic, the most characteristic of the patient at any particular time. And as they change, then you might treat other miasms and symptoms that are deeper down. There's also been an expansion of this, of the concept of miasms, to include what you might call iatrogenic miasms, or miasms that have been imposed on a person due to drugging. So there might be, some people might talk about a steroid miasm, because the person has taken so many steroids, they've got this miasm imposed upon them. Or if a person smokes lots of pot, they might have like a cannabis miasm imposed on them. Or you might say that if a person has been poisoned by vaccines or thimerosal, that they have a vaccine miasm. So really, this is somewhat confusing, the notion of a miasm with a poisoning. And a poisoning layer also probably has to be removed by homeopathic treatment if it's very deep and difficult. And often, as I've talked in previous shows, this might be treated by giving the substance, the offending substance, in homeopathic potency. But these iatrogenic miasms or poisoning layers are really kind of different in concept than the original notion of miasm, which is considered to be much deeper, but it's hard to know. It's hard to know whether, let's say, a vaccine miasm or a steroid miasm could be passed on to future generations. Not sure. We don't know yet. But it's interesting to consider that these might also be miasms as well. And some people think of them that way. Another thing that's evolved is in treatment is the deliberate sort of goal of removing miasms from the person. In Hahnemann's day and in general homeopathic practice, the miasmatic theory is just used to help you select a remedy. You don't specifically go and say, I'm going to treat your syphilitic miasm. But this has become more common in recent years too. And often this is done by giving nozodes to treat the miasms. A nozode is a remedy made from the specific disease that is considered to cause the miasm. Every disease, any disease, can have a nozode made from it. You know, if a person has a disease and there's the nozode will be made from some excretion of the person who has the disease. So tubercular miasm, the tubercular remedy, there is tuberculinum, and it is made from the discharge, from disease discharge of a tubercular person. Kind of icky, but these remedies are extremely important. Carcinosin, which was the remedy that cured my son of autism, and is a relatively common, but not always the right remedy, but fairly common in autism treatment, is made from cancer. So these nozode remedies made from disease substance are very important, very, very deep, serious remedies. They should only be used by homeopaths. And they are considered to treat the miasm of their respective diseases. But once again, let me remind you that they may not be the right remedy for a person. It really depends on the person, their symptoms. So for example, as I mentioned before, Thuja is considered the canonical remedy for treating the psychotic miasm, but the nozode for the psychotic miasm is Medarinum, made from gonorrhea. So, you know, which is the correct one for your child? It depends. Sometimes patients are treated with Thuja very successfully. I know of autism cases cured with Thuja. Or it might be Medarinum. It really depends on the symptoms of the patient. And all these nozode remedies have symptoms associated with them, just like any other remedy. So you just match the remedy to the patient. If the person's symptoms call for a nozode, then you give the nozode, just like any other remedy. Okay. Another way that the miasms have been used in recent years is as a theory, to form a basis of a theory or method of treatment. And the person who's most well known for this is Rajan Sankaran, one of our most prominent homeopaths in the world today, an Indian homeopath. And he's come up with a whole theory, and this is considered to be controversial, but is increasingly used with success, and he is a brilliant homeopath. So what he has done is he's found that each of the miasms, and he's the person who's come up with 10 miasms, each miasm is associated with a sort of an attitude or feeling towards life, a way that the person approaches life. So he looks at his patients and he says, he sort of, as part of the interview, figures out which of these miasms he fits into, not just based on the symptoms, but on this more mental attitude. Then he has also determine, especially in his use of plant remedies, each person also has a certain kind of sensation about all their symptoms. Let's say all the sensations of the person tend to be bursting, something, this feeling of everything's exploding or bursting. Their physical symptoms, their mental symptoms, all have this quality of a kind of bursting quality. And he's identified like a certain family, let's say, of plants that all tend to have this characteristic. So he'll say, they have this bursting sensation in all their symptoms, so it must be this family of plants, but they have this miasmatic quality. And he's said, well, in this family of plants, this particular plant is the one in that miasm. And using that method, he picks this particular remedy, this plant family, and that particular plant in the family based on the miasm. And so a lot of homeopaths are starting to use this method. Some people consider it wrong-headed, and some people have found it very successful. It might be interesting to let you know like about what these mental attitudes of these miasms are. So let's go back to Sora, which we already talked about. The Soric person, their sort of attitude is they've got a problem, but it's solvable. So there's the sense is that you have to work really hard, but you can do it. And so the person will be kind of optimistic, or they might give up. They might give up, feel despairing and give up. But they have the sense that if they really worked hard, they could do it. And Sankaran's kind of keyword phrase for this is, if I make an effort, I can do it. And the sort of situation is like the situation of the teenager who's learning to drive. It's frustrating, but if they work hard, they can do it. The psychotic miasm, which we talked about, that person feels like this. They feel like there's a weakness in me that I have to cover up. And they have to keep that weakness hidden from others. And so they will tend to feel a lot of guilt and remorse and self-reproach. They feel exposed. It's like a person who practices without the proper qualification. So they're covering up their weakness. And their feeling is, I can't change, but I'm not going to let anybody else see my weakness. The syphilitic miasm, we've talked about that one, they feel like there is no hope, that this is way beyond their capacity, and they've committed a crime, and it's their fault. It's their responsibility. So this is a very deep, dark thing. There's a feeling of complete despair, self-destruction. That's why you have this self-destruction. It's the feeling of like a person who's the captain of a sinking ship. They're responsible, but it's hopeless. They're going down with the ship. The task is hopeless. They're doing the best they can, but this is it. That's the feeling of the syphilitic miasm. The tubercular miasm, they have the feeling of being caught or suffocated. The gap is narrowing. Time is short. So there's that feeling of they're trying, hectic activity, and then they burn out, like I said. It's like a man who's trapped in a very narrow tunnel. The time is short. There's too much to be done in too little time. Sort of this almost suffocation feeling like, and you think about tuberculosis, the person in the respiratory symptoms, they're feeling suffocated. They can't do it. They're trapped. And finally, the cancer miasm. We talked about this. The cancer person feels like this task is way beyond my limits. Things are out of control, but things are like chaos, and I have to deal with it by keeping things under control. So that's where you get the perfectionism. It's like everything's going out of control, but I just got to try to control it. It's like the child of alcoholic parents. Their world is like chaos. They're a small person with a huge task, and they just have to keep things in total control. That's the cancer miasm. Very interesting, isn't it? One other final thing. I saw a talk this year that I thought was fascinating. Australian homeopath named Grant Bentley did several years study on the facial features of his patients, trying to find common facial features that are common to the miasms. I think it was something like a six-year study. He took photos of all his patients and then also did an analysis of the miasms and what remedies he gave and whether they were successful or not. And he did consistently find that certain facial features were characteristic of certain miasms and those, if he gave the right remedy for the facial features, I mean, in the right miasm, he was more successful. And now he started to use this information, facial feature information, to determine the miasm and to guide the treatment. I thought it was really fascinating. So that's about all I want to say about miasms. I hope I didn't make you more confused, but I hope I gave you some clarity here. Just in conclusion, miasms are an important area of study for all homeopaths. So all homeopaths should be educated in the use of miasms. They're part of the case, and they're part of case analysis. But they should not be viewed allopathically, in my opinion. They shouldn't be viewed like you come in and say, I've got the syphilitic miasm. Will you treat my syphilitic miasm? It's more subtle than that. And there's many, many remedies that are associated with, that can be used to treat any miasm. And most people have more than one miasm, and really is up to the discretion and the judgment of the homeopath which miasm they think is uppermost in your case and which they're going to use to treat. So it's not, it's really important to get away from allopathic thinking that, you know, you've got this thing, this miasm that you're going to get out. It's not like that. It's part of your whole makeup. You've inherited it, and it's a guide to help you find the most effective route to treatment. Also, this is not an introductory subject. This is a subject that's very deep. Homeopaths usually aren't even taught about miasms till like their third year of study, at least not deeply. And so, you know, I just warn parents not to get too fixated on this idea. If your homeopath is a well-trained person and experienced, they will know how to use miasms in their analysis, I would hope. So that's about it for today. I hope this was interesting to all of you. Like I said, next month's show again, interview with Ian Lupker. And just a final reminder again to check out the ImpossibleCure.com website, also National Center for Homeopathy.org, and join the National Center. I hope you'll do that. And remember, be well, and there truly is hope with homeopathy.